there, everybody. It is Thursday, March 21st, 2013, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us an email. Send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have so much ground to cover on this week's episode. We must get started with our first guest. Luke Yankee has directed, produced, taught, lectured, and acted throughout the country and abroad. He has run two regional theaters, serving as producing artistic director of the Long Beach Civic Light Opera, one of the largest musical theaters in America, and the Struthers Library Theater, a historic landmark in northwestern Pennsylvania. His writing for television has included work for Nurse Jackie, Royal Pains, Brothers and Sisters, and my favorite, Pushing Daisies. Let's bring that back, Luke. He has directed and produced more special events with more Hollywood luminaries than I could even begin to list. His first book, Just Outside the Spotlight, is in my hands right this very second. It details the life and times of his late mother, Eileen Heckert, who won an Academy Award for Butterflies Are Free. She won multiple Emmy Awards, a Tony. She appeared in over 15 feature films, 20 Broadway plays, and countless television programs. I am telling you right now, listeners, as I will tell you throughout this chat with Luke, go and buy this book, Just Outside the Spotlight. Go buy it right now, or maybe after you're done listening. Luke Yankee, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much, Ken.
I had to abbreviate your intro because we wouldn't have any time to talk, Luke.
You did just fine.
Okay, just checking. Now, can we just dive in? Are you ready?
I am so ready.
Okay. Luke, the book is surreal. I get that you lived it and all, but is there a part of you that's able to step back and say, this can't all have happened?
Not really. I mean, you know, when I was a kid and my mom was doing so much work on Broadway and mainly on television at that time, I mean, I just thought, I was probably about 6 or 7 years old before I realized that not every kid sat and watched their mom on TV on Saturday night. I just kind of thought it's what you did, you know? I mean, with all of the amazing stories and all the amazing people I've met, there certainly are some of those surreal moments. And one of the ones, I think, one of the most important ones for me was when I met Marlene Dietrich.
Oh, we'll get to that. I am not emotionally there yet, Luke. I am not emotionally there.
Okay.
Yeah, just
okay,
wait.
I won't jump the gun.
Just wait. Let's talk about process. I love talking about process with our writers. And you wrote this, and I get nervous quoting from the beginning of the book because then the guests are going to think I didn't read the rest, but I did. So you wrote, my friends were right. The gold mine was the legacy I had inherited. These weren't just dishy showbiz stories. Mama was so much more than that. They became life lessons about how to enter a room as if you belong there, how to treat people with respect, to stand up for what you believe in, and how to hone your craft, whatever it may be. What was your process of actually...
I wrote that quote. Wow, I wrote that?
You did. Well,
I'm
making the assumption that you did.
Damn, and... I'm good.
But what was your process? You had all of these stories and this realization that hit you of you are the collector of these stories. How did you actually sit down and put them all together? Did you have a special place that you wrote in?
Not really, Ken. I mean, I was the youngest son, and I was the gay son.
Yeah.
So I was the one, I was sort of the keeper of the flame, you know? I was the one who, at the cocktail parties with people like Mary Tyler Moore and Teresa Wright and on and on and on, where I was the one who would always sit at mom's feet and just listen to all of these amazing stories from all of these amazing people. And I knew, and she was such an incredible storyteller, and I knew that she was never going to write a book, and I knew that if I didn't do something with these stories, that they would be lost forever.
Yeah.
And this is a really crucial, in my estimation, portion of Broadway and Hollywood memorabilia from really the golden age.
You have this sentence in that paragraph, these stories were insights into another time, the golden age of Broadway and Hollywood, and I kept coming back. I have it highlighted. I kept coming back to that sentence because as I'm reading and as I'm getting more and more incredulous, not that I'm doubting you, but just as it gets more and more surreal, I don't know, I got a little bit wistful because there was this sense that it just doesn't feel like this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who has immersed himself in Hollywood and the theater world, do you have that sense of this is an era gone?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are a couple of very special people who were childhood friends, the two that immediately come to mind are the great Broadway actress Marion Seldes.
Yes.
And also Elizabeth Wilson, who played Dustin Hoffman's mother in The Graduate, and so many Broadway plays, and also is best known for playing Roz, Dabney Coleman's sidekick in 9 to 5.
Yes, of course.
And Elizabeth is, she was my mother's understudy in Picnic on Broadway in 1952, and went on to do so many amazing things. And Elizabeth is in her 90s now. And I speak with her every couple of months, and she is so vital to me because she is sort of the last link, one of the last links to that era.
Yeah.
And it's we just sort of, when we meet in person, which isn't that often because we're on opposite coasts, we just sort of look into each other's eyes and just kind of weep gently. Because we know that we're part of an era that doesn't exist anymore.
I can't get the image out of my head now of her on that plane at the end of 9 to 5 practicing her French tapes and whatnot.
Exactly.
But let's talk about why that's important. Because I'll be very upfront with you. My listeners know, you know, I'm 36 years old. I'm kind of at this weird crossroads of knowing the things that I know and these names in the book because I'm obsessed with knowing about the golden age of Hollywood. But I also know that I can't go out and about with a lot of my peers and drop some of these names and have people have any idea what I'm talking about. What are people missing by not knowing about all of these incredible people?
Well, you know, I'm also an acting teacher, and one of the things that just makes me crazy is that when young actors don't have a sense of theater history, I mean, when young actors don't know who Henry Fonda is,
right.
When they don't know who, I mean, you know, I don't even expect them, unfortunately, to know who Eileen Heckert is anymore.
Right.
But, and I just think it's so important for them to have a sense of the legacy of the past. I mean, that's why I just felt I had to write this book. It was so important to me to just make sure that these stories didn't die. And as I said before, I knew that if I didn't do something with them, they would be gone forever.
Right. Right. Well, let's talk about your mother. This weekend, I rented Butterflies Are Free. I had never seen it before.
Ah.
I feel that there are three parts to this movie. Part one, your mom is not in. Part two, your mom is in. And part three, she's not in. I did not enjoy parts one and three as much as part two.
Well, it's very sweet, but it's very dated. I mean, it's sort of from that, you know, 70s era of films like Cactus Flower and that sort of thing. And it was wonderful for its time, but, you know, dear sweet Goldie Hawn in her 20s running around in her bikini briefs calling things groovy, you know, it doesn't necessarily hold up all that well. I do think my mother's performance holds up very well. Of course, I'm biased. But she had done the role for almost 2 years by the time she did the film. She had done it on Broadway. She had done it in London. She even took it on tour to Columbus, Ohio, so her mother could see it. So by the time she did the film, she certainly knew this character and this role inside and out.
I think some of the things that she says hold up. Like, I wish I had retorts like that. Holy cow, does she skewer. Goldie Hawn's boyfriend towards the end, Ralph. I was a little nervous for him. I did not want to take on your mother in that role. It was unbelievable.
And her boyfriend, Ralph, that was played by Paul Michael Glaser, who went on to do Starsky and Hutch and the film of Fiddler on the Roof and so many amazing things.
But was there ever a Tevye like you, Luke? I wasn't even planning on going there. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. I'm not really ready for that either.
That's very funny.
So then your mother wins the Academy Award.
Yes.
You are at home fielding phone calls, by the way, from the New York Times, which I think is hilarious.
At age 13, yes.
Not the longest Academy Award speech in memory.
Not at all.
Have you ever timed it?
You know, I haven't, but she was very famous for say it and get off. I mean, she couldn't stand those people who did speeches that went on and on and on and thanked their agent and all of that. I think she had a bit of a regret in retrospect, although she never really voiced this to me. I think she had a bit of a regret that she didn't thank my father.
Yeah.
Because my father, Jack Yankee, was an amazing man, and they were married for 53 years before he passed. But, you know, other than that, she did. It was very short and very sweet. And, I mean, you know, you blink and it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
It's over. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to give away my age here. Maybe I shouldn't do this, but I just realized this year at the Oscars that it was 40 years ago this year that she won the Oscar.
Oh my gosh.
It was amazing to me that, I still remember every detail of that evening like it was yesterday.
Our listeners can't do math. They didn't add up that 40 and your age at the time. It's okay. Don't worry about that.
Thank you.
Don't worry about that. Yeah, it really was. You could watch it over and over because it's such a, she accepted the award and she's gone. There she goes. Where'd she go? There she goes.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that really cracked me up about that is that they sent her a copy of the clip in black and white. That's how long ago it was.
Right.
And then many years later, I actually saw it in color. And I said, Mom, I just saw that clip in color, and I didn't realize that you were wearing blue eyeshadow. And she said, I never wore blue eyeshadow in my life. I said, Mom, it was the early 70s. Everybody wore blue eyeshadow. Not me. I never wore blue eyeshadow. Well, if you look at the clip on YouTube, sure enough, she's wearing blue eyeshadow.
That is so funny. And, of course, all the comments on YouTube are all about the laughter around Shelley Winters.
Yes, yes. If you look at the YouTube clip, Robert Duvall and Cloris Leachman announce the nominees, and when Robert Duvall gets to Shelley Winters' name, he bursts into hysterical laughter. And it sounds like he's laughing at Shelley Winters, but that was not at all the case. He locked eyes in the audience with James Caan, who was his drinking buddy, and they had done The Godfather the year before. And just at that moment, James Caan made some obscene gesture, which was one of their private jokes. And Robert Duvall totally lost it on national television all over the world. Well, needless to say, Miss Winters was not pleased. He called her the next day and apologized, but the damage was already done.
Yes, you used that phrase in the book as well. The damage has already been done, and I kind of want to know what the next two sentences are because I would not want to cross Shelley Winters.
No, definitely not. And, of course, she had already won, I believe, 2 Oscars.
Yes.
And so when she got back, and everyone thought she was going to win, and so when my mother finally got back to her seat after all the press and everything, Shelley turned around and said, "So how many is this for you, Heckert?"
Oh.
And Mom said, "It's my first, Shelley. Give me a break."
There is this amazing, I fell into this YouTube hole last night of just looking at old award speeches, and there's this amazing collection. Someone put together this nice collection of all the best supporting actresses over the past, since they started presenting the award, and putting your mother in this context of all of these other actresses, it was stunningly beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it was really quite nice. Okay, now we can talk about Marlene Dietrich. Okay, so you go to see Marlene Dietrich in...
It was up in Connecticut.
It was in Connecticut.
It was their one-woman show.
Okay, it was in Connecticut. That's right. It's in Connecticut.
Right.
This is what you write. One look at her jeans outfit told you that these weren't Jordache specials off the rack, but a denim suit custom made with wide lapels and a tapered waist. My brother Philip kissed Dietrich's hand when he was introduced. When I went to shake her hand, she held it the entire time she spoke to us. Her perfume was so strong, I knew you could smell it a block away. For a star-struck kid like me, this was a religious experience. Did you indeed find God in that moment? Because I did, in just reading it.
Boy, when I hear that phrase, I mean, the book came out in 2006, and when I hear that phrase, it's like, oh my God, I am so gay.
You're on the right show right now. This is why we cover this, Luke.
Clearly. Of all the amazing people I met over the years, Ken, that is certainly one of the top five and may even be number one, right up there with Ethel Merman, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Oh, yes.
But I will never forget. We were standing backstage at the Candlewood Theater in Connecticut, and we'd just seen Miss Dietrich's one-woman show. And she had been very close to my mother for a certain period of time. And so we're backstage, and she just held my hand the entire time. And for 3 days... my right hand smelled like Marlene Dietrich. And I remember I was in grade school, and I would get the hall pass, and I would go into the boys' room, and I would just sniff my hand. And so that's why that chapter in the book is called Smelling Marlene Dietrich.
Look at that. I don't even have a lot of comments on that one, Luke. It kind of speaks for itself right there.
Kind of does.
I love it. I do not want to get through this interview without talking about your father. And I think I think that would be in some ways, you know, of course your mother is this presence. Your father plays such, I'm telling you, he plays such an important role in your life. But he, in the book and in the narrative of the book, I really can't picture reading this without your father's presence. And you write at one point, he was a tender, loyal husband and a wonderfully caring, supportive father. Jack Yankee was one of the kindest men I ever met. He was the type of man anyone would have wanted to have him as a best friend. He was confident, generous, laughed easily, and he immediately made you feel like you'd known him all of your life. We can talk about Eileen until the cows come home, but where is your dad in this text?
Thank you so much for that, Ken, because so often, of course, he is eclipsed by her. I mean, she was such a larger-than-life presence, but he was an amazing man. In fact, when the song "You Are the Wind Beneath My Wings" first came out, before Bette Midler popularized it, and I believe, it was somebody like Tony Bennett. I don't think that's right, but someone sort of that ilk who sang it on a television special. And my mother got a VHS of it and gave that to my father for Christmas because she said, "Jack, this is you. You are the wind in my wings." And he was such an extraordinary man. You just quoted from the book. He was quiet and patient and loving and sort of from that generation of men who were just very quiet and strong.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it. He was, I actually had the experience of directing him in a community theater production of The Diviners, a wonderful play about a farm community in Indiana, written by the brilliant Jim Leonard. And he was just, he was so wonderful. And not only, when my mother would be on the West Coast for long stretches of time, they lived in Connecticut, he would do community theater basically kind of out of boredom and because it was fun for him. And unlike the rest of us who did it as, you know, as a serious endeavor, he just did it for fun. But I remember he was so incredibly nervous because this was the first full-length play I directed, and he was so nervous about not letting me down. He would walk around the house with the script in his back pocket, studying his lines every single moment. And on opening night, I'll never forget going backstage and saying, "Papa, you were so wonderful in this, and I am so incredibly proud of you." And two little tears just rolled down his cheek. It just, I was so incredible. It was a defining moment of my life.
Yeah. And I'm sure of his.
Yeah.
I'm sure of his.
Yeah. He was just a remarkable man. And thank you so much for bringing him up, because a lot of times in these sorts of interviews, people don't, because the diva, as I said, is just so strong and there's so much to talk about with her. But no, he was... he was a gift in every sense of the word.
Well, let's talk about him as part of a couple a little bit more, because as I read, quote, "Just after I turned 18, I came out to my parents. I was too afraid to look them in the eye as I told them. So one spring night, I sat them down in the living room and read them a letter I had written." Now, I noticed, Luke, that the text of the letter, not here in the book.
No.
No. Where can I get my hands on the text of the letter, Luke?
I'm afraid you can't. It was very difficult for them to deal with because, you know, even though all of my mother's directors and dressers, et cetera, were gay, and even though, of course, there were so many friends of the family who were, people like, you know, the famous director Morton DaCosta, who directed The Music Man and Auntie Mame, et cetera, but for people of that generation, it was a different thing when it was their baby.
Right.
And there, when you think about it, unlike today, there were no positive role models. I mean, you know, most gay people that they knew were either alcoholics or committed suicide or, you know, were very unhappy, tortured people. And they were very, very upset because, and I realize this in retrospect, they didn't want that kind of a life for me.
Yeah.
And it took them a long time to come around and to really to understand it and to get, they felt that this was a choice that I had made
right.
rather than something in my DNA.
Right.
And it took them, just being of that generation, it took them a very long time to come to terms with it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to say that they finally did. And my husband of 18 years, Don Hill, when my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, one of the first things she said to me, before she even told me that she was terminal, she said, "Do you think Don would want to call me Mom?"
That part of the book.
And so for this lady who had had such a hard time with my coming out, to be saying, lo, these years later, you know, "Do you think your partner would want to call me Mom?" In fact, the last gift that she gave to Don before she passed away was a letter opener that she had engraved, and on one side was his initials, and on the back it said, "Love, Mom."
Mm.
And in fact, she was having such difficulty, because she died just a few days after Christmas, and, you know, with the morphine, she was kind of in and out because she was in such terrible pain with lung cancer. And in fact, the gift wasn't even found until after she had passed.
Wow. Wow.
And she kept saying on that last Christmas, "There's another package for Don. There something's missing here." I mean, she just knew, and of course for him to receive it after she had already gone just made it all the more poignant, and he just cried and cried.
Well, let's not paint this Don Hill as too prodigal a son-in-law, even though he is, as we all well know, the outstanding professor of the year from the Claire Trevor School of the Arts at UC Irvine.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you knew that, but it's kind of a big deal. He certainly, at the last Christmas, he did not put the knives on the right side of the plate.
Wow, you're hitting amazing stuff here. So my mother, we're getting into a heavy place here. My mother was determined. She loved Christmas so much, and she was determined to get through one last Christmas.
Yeah.
She was very, very ill. And so, of course, we're all pitching in and doing what we can, and she's coming out, you know, in her walker and in severe pain for her last Christmas dinner. And she looks at the table and she says, "Who set this table?" I mean, she's, you know, barely alive at this point.
Right.
And he just immediately is like, I did, Eileen. Is something wrong?
She's well, like, can I just stop you right there? Has he not seen Butterflies Are Free? Because if he had seen the movie, there's no way in hell that I would have taken responsibility for something that clearly was awry. So let me just say, I don't think he had seen the movie at that point.
Well, he had.
Okay.
He had, but he was a very, he's a very responsible man.
Okay.
In many ways.
All right.
And, in fact, when he and I finally got together, I said, since we were just talking about my dad, I said to Mom, "You know, I think I found my Jack Yankee."
Yeah.
And she's like, "Really?" So anyway, the knives were on the wrong side, and he fessed up that he was the one who had set the table, and she said, "Well, I knew it wasn't one of my boys. My boys know how to set a proper table." So, you know, on her deathbed, she still knows, she's still determined that the her final Christmas dinner table is going to be Martha Stewart perfect.
Yeah. I'm still maintaining he never saw the movie. If he saw the movie, he would have kept his trap shut and said, "I have no idea who did that. Who would have done that?" Just saying. I don't want to start any marital strife right now,
but he's a man of too much integrity for that.
All right. I question that. But okay. There is, I have to tell you, my favorite line that I have dog-eared and highlighted and whatnot. Your mother gets a part in Veronica's room.
Yeah.
Which sounds like quite the plot. Yeah. I'll leave that there. She asks you if you want to see some of the play. You, of course, say, "I'd love to." And this is what you write, these two sentences. She proceeded to act out a number of the monologues. Even though it was my mother joyously sharing her current project with me, part of me was thinking, this is a great actress doing a command performance for me alone. And those couple lines were such an incredible entry point for the reader to just see things through your lens, to see that dichotomy of, this is a woman who embodies talent, and she's also your mom.
Well, exactly. And I'm thrilled with some of the quotes you're picking out, Ken. I'm very honored. And that was the thing. I mean, there were definitely the two women. There was Mom, who up in Connecticut was Mrs. Yankee. And then there was Eileen Heckert.
Yeah.
And I write about how you were never quite sure whether you were going to get the diva or the mom.
Right.
But at that moment in time, it was, I mean, I was experiencing the dichotomy in the best sense of it. Because I was, you know, this, as I said, this was mom sharing her latest project with me. And this was one of Ira Levin's next projects after Rosemary's Baby, a very intense gothic horror play, very complex character. And this was also her first Broadway play after having won the Oscar, so there was a lot riding on it. And she was so excited about this play. And so she's doing this monologue for me, this three-page monologue where this woman talks about speaking about basically murdering her sister.
Yeah.
And I'm just in awe. We're in the middle of the living room, and she sits an empty chair there, and the empty chair represented the actress she was telling this story to. And I'm sitting on the sofa, not 10 feet away, and I'm just thinking, holy shit.
Yeah.
This is an amazing actress. And I think I was, 13 or 14 at the time.
Unbelievable.
And I got it. I mean, I got it at a very early age.
There was one interesting part. It's funny. I'm about, 118, 119 pages through the book, and I'm reading along. And for some reason, I started thinking that there were a lot of parallels between your mother and her journey and Elaine Stritch. And then all of a sudden, Elaine Stritch pops up in the book.
Right.
Which was incredible because I don't know. And I honestly, now knowing that she's in the book and I can't quite go back and unring that bell and thinking, I don't remember why I was thinking this, there's some parallels here and there's some Elaine Stritchiness to this. And then all of a sudden there's Elaine Stritch.
Well, they were very similar types. They were up for a lot of the same roles. And, my mother felt a great rivalry with Elaine Stritch.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I had an opportunity to speak with Elaine about it, and I got that Elaine never really felt that. She had tremendous respect for, or if she did, she certainly didn't voice it to me. She had tremendous respect for my mother, but I remember there were times that Mom would say to me, you know that Jack Lemmon movie I was up for? Stritch got it. And just the way she said the word, you sort of got a whole picture. But they were up for a lot of the same roles. And as a matter of fact, the night my mother was inducted into the Theater Hall of Fame was a very incredible evening. I was so honored to be there for that. The MC for the evening that night was Elaine Stritch.
Wow.
And Elaine was so thrilled for her. I mean, you sort of got that rivalry was certainly not on Elaine's side.
Right.
And I know they had tremendous respect for one another, definitely. Whatever rivalry my mother felt, she certainly respected Elaine greatly.
Well, you mentioned the Theater Hall of Fame, and if we could take a step back a bit and talk a little bit about theater. You know, we've certainly tried over the past 4-plus years on the show to highlight, certainly we've talked about Broadway any number of times and had actors on and some producers and some reviewers just to bring a sense of Broadway to our listeners all over the world who may not have been able to access it. And so we've certainly made the point that Broadway as an art form is known to some degree. And every time we've talked about it, we've been talking about musicals. And it strikes me, you have the musicals, which are somewhat known, but then we talk about more of the straight theater, you know, the non-musicals, which you just don't hear about nearly as much as you got the sense even from reading this text that you used to.
Right. Right. Exactly. And that was really, I mean, my mother always played sort of the second banana in the films. And where she was really considered Broadway royalty in the 50s and 60s. And of course, you know, worked way beyond that. In fact, I mean, her last Broadway play, The Waverly Gallery, was just before she died, where it was a really devastatingly powerful play by Kenneth Lonergan, who wrote, the film You Can Count on Me,
yeah,
and so many other wonderful things.
Yeah.
And this was about, it was based on his grandmother, and it was a play about a woman's descent into Alzheimer's. And at age 81, my mother won more awards for a single performance in a single season than any actress in theater
history. Unbelievable.
I mean, it was a devastating performance. And it was written the way an Alzheimer's patient speaks, so it was all, you know, nonsense. So many of her lines were non sequiturs. And it was, I will never forget. In fact, people like the wonderful actor James Caron, who did so many wonderful character actors, done so many things. He has said that as one of many people who said that of the great performances in theater history, he thinks of Jason Robards in The Iceman Cometh,
yeah.
Lorette Taylor in The Glass Menagerie, Shirley Booth in Come Back, Little Sheba, and Eileen Heckert in The Waverly Gallery.
Look at that.
And because it was such an incredibly intense and devastating play, it didn't run for very long.
Right.
Because once the diehard theater community had seen it, it was just too heavy for the general public. But, I mean, my mother's performance, that was actually what finally got her an honorary Tony just before she died.
Right. Do you and Don ever talk about, I mean, we rail against, and you even mention it towards the end of the book, just about your jaunt to the producers, which cost, quite a bit of money just to go see the producers. We rail all the time on the show that so much of this art form is denied to so many people because it is so exorbitant.
It really is, and gosh, there are just so many factors.
I should say this, as I've said many times on the show before, that I say this as someone who grew up, I'm very fortunate that we lived right over the George Washington Bridge, and our parents took us to shows constantly, and I can't even imagine someone still being able to do that because it's so expensive.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, thank God for the half-price booth, but even the half-price booth for
$100
these days, it's crazy, or close to that. But, gosh, there are just so many factors that come into play there, Ken, in terms of, health insurance.
Right.
And, all of the unions, and it's just really, when you look at something like, for instance, Holland Taylor has this wonderful one-woman show about Ann Richards right now, and it's a one-woman show, which she wrote herself, and there's about a dozen producers on it. For one person, one set, one costume, all of that,
right.
Because it's just become so exorbitant.
I want people to know this art form more than they do, and even so, it's this whole dichotomy of when you talk about Broadway, it automatically goes to the musicals, and apparently some new musical where people have their hands on a truck and they're starting to sing. I can't believe what's coming out these days. But the straight theater is, it just feels like sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle.
Well, that's one of the ways, really, just thinking about all of the theater my mother did over the years, and thank heavens, all of the film and television she did.
Right.
Because one of the ways where I am incredibly blessed is that, unlike many people, is that I can look back and I can see my mother at age 30,
right.
At age 40,
right.
At age 50, when she was sort of in her prime doing all of these amazing roles. I mean, there's a wonderful clip of her doing Picnic, which was her first Broadway show in 1952, on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
And a friend sent me that a couple of years after she died, and it was just so exciting to see a clip from this role that had put her on the map.
Right.
I mean, I've got this incredibly rich legacy that is just so rewarding and so thrilling.
And accessible. We love that
yes,
it's accessible.
Indeed.
Well, we don't have a ton of time left, so we got to get to your song selections for this week's episode, and we only have time for a couple of them. This is the part of the show, Luke Yankee, where you tell our listening audience, and I know there's stories behind it, but you still have to conform to our rules. This is the part of the show where you tell our listening audience what a couple of your song selections say about Luke Yankee. It's a little self-analysis for our listening audience.
Okay.
I know. I'm a little nervous for this. So the first one, and of course we can't have you not tell the story, but the first one that you chose was Some People from Gypsy, the Ethel Merman version. So first, tell us the story about Ethel Merman, and then we got to do a little self-analysis of you based on that song.
Okay. Well, I'll cut to the chase because I know we're running tight on time. Ethel Merman came to my parents' Christmas party when I was 9 years old and taught me how to make a martini.
Ugh.
And it was a real Auntie Mae moment in my life. And she was actually great with kids. And so for the rest of the evening, whenever anyone would say, "Merm, can I freshen your drink?" she would put her hand over the glass and say, "No, thank you. Luke's taking care of me." And she was very, very sweet with me. And it was really, like the Marlene Dietrich moment. It was one of those moments I will never forget.
Yeah.
Of Ethel Merman teaching me how to make a martini.
And then you showed her your puppets, and that wasn't even a metaphor.
It was not a metaphor.
Not a euphemism, not a metaphor. He actually had puppets. I love that.
I showed her my puppet collection. Yes.
Now, why some people from Gypsy? What do we think some people from Gypsy says about Luke Yankee?
Well, it's, I think it's kind of obvious, actually. It's like, you know, some people can sit in the living room and some people can get out there and make things happen.
There
and I always consider myself somebody who gets out there and makes things happen.
Nice. All right, we have time for one more quick one. I have to tell you, I do not, and I feel they're going to take away my gay card, I do not know Godspell at all. I don't know it at all. So this song that we're about to play later on in the show, All Good Gifts, what does All Good Gifts say about Luke Yankee?
This song to me is like going to church. It is a very spiritual song. And basically it's saying that it's about being in a constant space of gratitude.
Nice.
And basically the recurring line of the song is, all good gifts around us are sent from heaven above.
Nice.
I consider myself more spiritual than I do conventionally religious, whatever that means. But I firmly believe that there is a higher power, whatever one chooses to call it, out there that is helping. And I call on that power a lot, and I am so grateful for all of the many blessings in my life.
Nice
that's
one.
What that song says to me.
Nice one. Well, we got coming up, I see on May 18th, you are doing Diva Dish, where you will be telling these stories. It's a benefit for the Anaheim Performing Arts Center, correct?
Actually, that has been postponed to the fall because the good folks in Anaheim had some other events coming up. But I'm constantly doing my one-man show, and I always do book signings when I do, and I've got, you know, a lot of other projects coming up, focusing mostly on some of my television projects at the moment, and a lot of exciting things. I have a new play called The Last Lifeboat, an untold story about the owner of the Titanic the owner of the White Star Line at the time of the sinking of the Titanic, which is getting attention from a lot of regional theaters. And just a lot of different projects out there coming up in the coming months.
Where should folks go to learn all about the cool things that you're doing?
Probably the best place is my website, which is www.lukeyankee.com.
Love it.
That's the way it sounds.
Love it. The book is called Just Outside the Spotlight, Growing Up with Eileen Heckert. Go, folks, right now. I mean, we barely touched any of this book. We covered maybe a half page. So get out there and go to wherever fine books are sold and pick up this book. I kept having to close it and say, shut up. And it's not that I was doubting you. I just was such shock we didn't even get to Martha Stewart. So much else just outside the spotlight, folks. Go pick it up. Luke Yankee, I could not be more appreciative for your allowing us access. And that's really what it came down to. Again, yes, there was the wistfulness, but I wouldn't even have been wistful if you hadn't provided the access. You use your voice in the most amazing way to give a voice to your parents, to give a voice to this whole age of just beauty and acting and talent, and just so appreciative that you took the time to write it all down.
Well, when people get it like you do, Ken, it is the greatest honor and the greatest gift I can think of. So thank you so much.
All the best. Luke, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ken.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom, living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people of 105. But that I gotta see yet, all the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be yet. Come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's peachy for some people, for some humdrum people to be.
All right, folks, and we are back. Hello, Jody.
Hello, Ken.
2 weeks in a row.
I know.
It's been a while since we've done that.
Yeah.
So I have had a full morning.
Yeah, you were saying.
I've had a full morning, but you don't know why.
No, I don't specifically.
So last night I watched How to Survive a Plague. Have you watched this?
No.
Oh, it's this. So it's this movie about ACT UP and TAG.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, not necessarily the movie to watch when you're feeling kind of like, feeling kind of blah tonight. Why don't I watch How to Survive a Plague? So it was nominated for an Oscar. It was an incredible movie. And so everybody should go out there and you can rent it on iTunes. It's like $3 or $4 and it's really quite incredible. So then this morning I was thinking, oh, I should go get tested. So I went and I got tested this morning and I went to the AIDS Project of Southern Vermont. And then I was thinking, oh, I would tell you on the air that I'm getting tested, but that feels really personal. But it shouldn't feel so personal because these are the things we're supposed to be talking about.
Right.
We're supposed to be encouraging people, not just you and I mean the community. People are supposed to be getting tested and they're supposed to be doing this work and increasing the visibility of HIV and AIDS. And I was just thinking that we're not doing enough. Again, not you and I, but
the
community and
in general.
This movie really messed me up. And
so it's
pretty
much
dictating everything that's happening with me today. Oh, before I forget, Luke Yankee, who was just on the last segment of the show, he has made an offer. He has made an offer for our listeners. So if you want to get a copy of his book, Just Outside the Spotlight, and have him autograph it for you. You can send him an email. I mean, you still have to pay for the book, but he'll autograph it for you and he'll write you a little inscription and just send him an email at luke@lukeyankee.net. And that's a special that he is doing for an exclusive special for our listeners. So I thought that was really nice. And
that is very cool.
As you heard me gush in the previous segment, you guys should all go and pick up the book Just Outside the Spotlight because it is quite incredible. And Luke will write to him and he will autograph it for you and write you something nice.
Awesome.
Gay news.
Gay news.
Here we go. Michelle Schacht.
Whoa. Haven't heard from her in a long time.
Did you hear about her this week, though?
No.
Oh.
No, what happened?
So Michelle Schacht, formerly kind of gay, now not at all gay.
Oh.
And not only is she not at all gay, but she said some stuff.
Uh-oh.
At a concert last week. She's a born-again Christian. That didn't happen at the concert last week. That preceded the concert last week. She had previously identified as bisexual a couple decades ago. Definitely not a couple days ago, because a couple days ago during her concert, she said, quote, that she lives in fear that the world will be destroyed if gays are allowed to marry.
What?
She went on to urge her stunned audience that they could go on Twitter and say, Michelle Schacht said, God hates fags. So now, our buddy John Becker's got a petition to get her concerts all kinds of canceled, and a ton of her concerts are now being canceled, left, right, up, and down. What the hell happened to Michelle Schacht in the past 2 decades?
Oh, dear.
So that's Michelle Schacht.
Oh, that's...
Not good.
No, it's not good at all.
It's not good.
No.
Speaking of... God, I can't believe I would ever say this. Speaking of God hates fags, turning to the Westboro Church, the Westboro Baptist Church. Did you hear about this?
I did. I saw that.
Isn't this fun?
It's very fun.
By the way, we're not talking about the Westboro Baptist
Church. No, they are not fun.
Aaron Jackson, he is a gentleman who took inspiration from a 9-year-old kid who stood up to Westboro Baptist Church protesters. Jackson is following through on a project that started about 6 months ago when he decided to buy a house across the street from the infamous church in Topeka, Kansas. He and his volunteers began painting the house in the colors of the Gay Pride rainbow. Once they are done, they will also add a huge rainbow flag in front of the house. He said, quote, it looks like something that should be at the UN, not in a residential neighborhood. His charity, Planting Peace, isn't that a lovely name?
That is nice.
Planting Peace.
Yeah.
They have opened orphanages and bought endangered forest land in Peru. They have now renamed that building Equality House, and the project seeks to fight bigotry. Isn't that amazing? So the pictures, you got to look at the pictures.
I've seen the pictures. Yeah, they're pretty great.
The Westboro Baptist Church had a response, and I can't read it because it's really...
Vulgar?
It's pretty bad.
Okay.
It's pretty bad. Yeah. I don't even know if I need to bleep out God hates fags. It's part of their whole
thing. Yeah.
I'm not going to bleep it out because people should know
that's
what they say. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about gay marriage. First, in a poll in a new poll, public support for gay marriage. This was just yesterday. This week, gay marriage has hit a new high as Americans increasingly see... I always get weird when the article says Americans increasingly see homosexuality not as a choice. It's just the biblical connotations of homosexuality. But just as the way some people are, the poll shows that 58% of Americans now believe it should be legal for gay and lesbian couples to get married. 36% say it should be illegal. Public attitudes towards gay marriage are a mirror image of what they were a decade ago.
They really flopped.
That's really quite nice. And part of that 58% is your hero, Hillary Clinton. Do you like Hillary?
I do. Yeah. I do like her.
I saw you as a Hillary supporter. I'm a Hillary supporter. I like Hillary.
Yep.
Hillary Clinton came out this week, not as gay, but certainly in support of gay marriage.
Yeah.
In a video released by the Human Rights Campaign, Hillary said, quote, LGBT Americans are our colleagues, our teachers, our soldiers, our friends, and our loved ones, and they are full and equal citizens and deserve the rights of citizenship. That includes marriage. That's why I support marriage for lesbian and gay couples. I support it personally and as a matter of policy and law. It's quite nice.
That is quite nice. That's very strong, too.
Very strong.
Yeah.
People are questioning if this is connected to perhaps a 2016 run.
I thought she had already confirmed she was thinking about it, like, for sure.
I thought she always says that she's not thinking about it. That she's not thinking about it, but that doesn't exclude it from running. Mm. I don't know.
I thought she had said she was thinking about it.
She would be. I mean, she would be really the first, if elected, the first person coming into office.
Yeah.
Who's saying, I support gay marriage.
Right.
Because that is not where President Obama started, though that is where he is now.
Right.
Would you like to talk about, we will talk about both, but I'll give you the choice which way you want to start.
Sure.
Would you like to talk about our education story of the week, or would you like to talk about Belarus?
They aren't the same story, are they?
They are not.
Okay.
They are two different stories. I'll give you the choice. Education or Belarus?
Let's go education first.
Okay. Education first. Gosh, it's another one of these stories.
Oh, no.
By the way, there's
no.
supposed to be an update on Chambersburg.
Oh.
Someone did write in and correct me.
Aha.
But I don't have the update on Chambersburg, so I don't know where they decided from last week on what they were doing in approving the student group. I will actually look that up as we're talking, and maybe we can get our hands on what's going on in Chambersburg. So the story of the week out of education, this is going to be one of those.
Oh, no.
It's really just kind of funny and not at all. A San Bernardino County school district allegedly discriminated against gay and lesbian students, including their apparel. It's their apparel.
What?
Because we are still at the point, even in Southern California, where we are not allowing girls to wear tuxedos.
What?
To the upcoming prom.
What?
Isn't that unbelievable?
Oh my gosh.
In a letter from the ACLU of Southern California, the Hesperia Unified School District was notified that they face legal action. The ACLU typically warns government agencies of impending litigation to give them the chance to make changes. The letter makes specific allegations against the faculty and administration of Sultana High School. It recounts, quote, persistent censorship of activities and announcements by the Gay Straight Alliance Club. This is from the letter, quote, indeed, the club's very name has typically been truncated from Gay Straight Alliance to GSA when morning announcements are read over the intercom with the words gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer omitted entirely. One announcement was submitted as, do you identify as straight, lesbian, bisexual, gay, or are you questioning everything? Come join Sultana's Gay Straight Alliance on Wednesdays at lunch in room W11. Join a group of students here on campus that support each other and want to make a difference for others. The announcement was allegedly broadcast instead as GSA meeting in W11. That's funny. Come on.
It's just kind of pathetic.
So there's that. And come on. There's also, they accuse the school of allowing and failing to investigate discriminatory remarks made by faculty and administration and pressuring the club's lesbian faculty advisor to leave.
Whoa.
So that's not good.
No.
And then there's the part about the dress code. Well, that you had someone throw a football at a kid. And then Levi Smithston Johnston, an 18-year-old senior at Sultana, hopes to wear heels with his tuxedo, but knows he will violate the dress code for boys if he does. The heels represent who he is, and he feels comfortable wearing them. And also barring girls from wearing tuxedos because they have a policy that students must be dressed in, quote, traditional gender-defined clothes.
Wow. And this isn't a private Catholic high school, correct?
No, it's not.
Okay. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
You don't like that one, do you?
No, I really don't like that one.
And I'm looking right now. I don't see any update on Chambersburg. So.
I think what would be really awesome is if that entire student body decided to make it the gender bender prom and everybody cross-dressed.
Yeah, but remember when that, what was it? They allowed, I can't believe I forgot her name already, and she was a big name 2 years ago, but they allowed that one student to take a partner to the prom or just a same-sex date.
Right.
And so they canceled the prom instead.
Which is ridiculous.
Prom.
This is so ridiculous.
Yeah. You didn't go to prom.
No, I did go to prom.
Oh, your wife did not go to prom.
My wife, I don't think,
oh,
went
that's
to prom.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't talk to your prom date anymore. I don't understand it.
No.
This is the time of year when I give a shout out to Mandy Filer. Mandy Filer, thank you for going to the prom with me. I very much appreciate it. And I'm sure you like being able to tell people that you went with a gay guy. Belarus.
Yeah.
Naturally, we must talk about Belarus, one of your favorite political figures in the world, President Alexander Lukashenko. Of Belarus.
Yep.
He has said that he does not have the resources to be a dictator, although he has admitted that he may be an authoritarian leader. I swear we're going to get to a gay part.
Okay.
He has denied gagging opponents, I assume, in the press.
Right.
But dismissed the opposition as what he calls the fifth column, finance from abroad. Okay, we're getting there.
Okay.
In an interview with the Russian TV channel Russia Today, recorded on March 15th and broadcast this week, the president denied reports that he was grooming his son or anyone else as a leader in waiting. He denied being aware of the German foreign minister's sexual orientation when he said he would rather be a dictator than gay in what was seen as a scornful comment about Guido Westerwelle. But there was little sign of remorse. This is what he said, quote. Uh-oh. I love this quote. We're dubbing this the quote of the week.
Oh, God.
Quote, I forgive women for their lesbianism, but I will never in my lifetime forgive men for being gay. A woman becomes a lesbian only if we men are so wretched.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Jody.
Wow. Wow.
I don't think people are going to be like, where's the extended commentary? I don't know that Jody and I have extended commentary on this one. Isn't that lovely?
Wow.
I would like to read his quote again. Quote,
okay.
I forgive women for their lesbianism, but I will never in my lifetime forgive men for being gay. A woman becomes a lesbian only if we men are so wretched.
Wow.
So, you're good. I mean, according to him, you are forgiven.
It's not my fault. It's because guys are terrible.
Not just terrible.
Yeah. Wretched.
Wretched.
They are wretched.
I should have maybe taken more of a pause between talking about your prom date and this story, because my hope is not that our listeners will connect those two stories. Otherwise, are you Facebook friends? You're not even Facebook.
No.
I don't understand. It because he was wretched? So wretched.
That would be it would make it so much easier to say, oh yes, that's why.
Did your lovely wife not go to the prom because
all the men were wretched?
The theme that year was under the wretched men sea or something. Oh, that's fun, isn't it?
Oh my God.
That's a good time.
Wow.
A woman becomes a lesbian. I don't even want to move on. I do have one more story, but I don't even want to talk about it. Because it's nice when folks are able to find out the root cause for homosexuality.
Right. It's wretchedness.
So there is, we've actually talked about this before, the kiss cam at various sporting events where the kiss cam, you know, on the big jumbotrons.
Uh-huh.
And if the kiss cam, it's got a border of like hearts and stuff, focuses on you and the person sitting next to you, then you kiss.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh.
President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, they've been caught on a kiss cam. So it usually gets some laughs at arenas and stadiums around the nation as the camera locks in on you.
Yeah.
But a longtime Jacksonville Jaguars fan noticed something on kiss cam that irked him. And this past week, he decided to do something about it. If you've seen the kiss cam, you know this trick. After a series of shots of men sitting next to women, kiss cam will sometimes frame a pair of players of the opposing team on the bench. Dave Ubley, who is gay, saw this gag and didn't think it was funny. He said, quote, I think I saw it maybe 2 years ago. Then I saw it this year. The thing is, they have the section at Jags games for honorable kids. Some are definitely going to be gay. It gives a negative angle. I just don't think it's necessary. It seems out of place to me. He decided to write the Jags owner Shad Khan about Kiss Cam on Monday after reading a story in the New York Times by Judy Batista about scrutiny on the NFL's handling of gay rights issues. There's a lot of attention right now on the NFL and how they're handling things. And so he wrote a letter, and he would like, you know, they do it as kind of a joke of one player from the Jags on split screen with someone from the opposing team. And and they should... they should kiss, even though we're not enough. So good for him for taking matters into his own hands and addressing. If you see things like that, folks, write a letter, because there are other people thinking the same thing. But if you actually take the time to write a letter, that might make a difference. You never know. You never know. So, so again, just to reiterate, Luke Yankee, thanks to Luke Yankee from our previous segment. It's really one of the most fun interviews I've ever done on this show. And if you want to get a copy of his book, Just Outside the Spotlight, you can write to him at luke@lukeyankee.net, and he will send a little inscription for you. And I'm sure he will inscribe it for someone else if you want that. And again, it's about this time era gone by, Hollywood times gone by, of people that we don't even know the names of anymore. And it's really sad, because what an era that is somewhat lost to us. And we talked about, we haven't talked about your Broadway experience. Have you been to Broadway shows?
I have. Not lots, but not have been.
It's, again, it's an opportunity that Jody and I have had, but it's an opportunity that so many people don't have, either because geographically they can't get there, or because it's so cost prohibitive at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
It's insane.
Yeah, it is insane. Yeah.
And it is a part of gay culture.
Yeah.
It is a it is embedded in gay culture. Yeah. So pick up his book, and you can access a little bit of Broadway Just Outside the Spotlight. So there's that. You can, of course, stroll on over to theshowisogay.com and learn all about the fun things that we're doing, and listen to all of our past shows. And right there, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes, and then it will just download automatically. Send us an email. I got to do the count. I was going to do the count this week of how many episodes you've done. And I think I say your name in every description that you're on, so it shouldn't be too hard.
Yeah,
but I think you got to be coming up on at least, what do you think?
I'm thinking maybe somewhere in the realm of 20.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, more.
Oh, you're...
way more?
Way wrong.
Oh, whoa. Okay. Okay.
Oh, no. You're definitely over 50 shows.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, this is episode 206.
Wow.
And you're definitely over 50
shows. Oh, I'm really curious. I really want to know.
So you can send Jody a happy 50th show email at jody@thisshowisogay.com. And of course, go to Facebook and join all the fun things happening there. I'm actually considering next week starting up the This Show Is So Gay Twitter account.
Oh.
I'm caving. It's been requested. Oh. I know. It's just one more thing, but I'll do it if it gets us listeners, because, you know, I'm desperate like that. All right. Get out there, folks. Go do some incredible things. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference in this world. We can't tell you how to do it, because you know what your talents are. Jody and I have different talents from each other, from you. We do different things, and that's what you need to do. Don't do what we do unless you're really good at it. Do what you do to raise up the voices of your LGBT brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're out there doing these great things, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Refreshing rain.